Okay, well, I'm ready to go if you're ready to go.
I'm ready to go. Let her rip.
Okay. All right. Well, Stephen, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
That was my pleasure.
I thought I would start off, as I usually do, just talking a little bit about background. And, I know you from your blog, which I follow and have plugged into my reader. There's also something a little bit about you that I'm not so sure about, and I think that people would like to know a little bit more about, is you work with the National Research Council of Canada, and what exactly is that, and what do you do with them?
Oh, well, that's an easy question with a long answer. National Research Council is Canada's national research agency. It's similar in some ways to NSF in the United States, although we're not a funding body, really. We're kind of like a national university, but without students. There's about 1,700 or so researchers. I'm one of the researchers with NRC. I think 1,699 of them have doctorates. I do not, which makes me a bit of an exception. I think 1,699 of them are proper scientists. My degree is in philosophy. So I'm a bit of an oddity in the National Research Council. Mostly the National Research Council does stuff on genetics, material sciences, aeronautics. There's a great big NRC wind tunnel at the Ottawa airport, oceanography, things like that. I work with a branch called the Institution for Information Technology, IIT, and IIT is among the youngest of NRC's 17 or so institutes, and it is focused on, as the name suggests, computer technologies. I work in a group called Learning and Collaborative Technologies. This group is based in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. And for people who don't know where Moncton is, it's in the eastern side of Canada. It's near Nova Scotia, but it's not in Nova Scotia. It's in a separate province called New Brunswick, which is just as nice as Nova Scotia, but bigger with more trees. The IIT itself is scattered in four locations: Ottawa, Gatineau, which is in Quebec, Fredericton, which is up the road here in New Brunswick, and of course here in Moncton. What I do, I'm a researcher, which gives me a pretty wide latitude, and you know, this is something that's changed a lot over the years. Basically, my work, the actual stuff that I do, is a combination of project management, writing academic articles, writing software, doing my newsletter, giving talks, and trying to be creative and forward-looking in the field of learning and collaborative technologies. In practice, what that's worked out to be these days, and again, it's changed over the years, but these days I do my newsletter, which is about 15% of my time. And when I say I do my newsletter, that also includes tweaking the software that runs the newsletter system. And then I do background or foundational research, which I categorize under the heading of learning networks. And, you know, this is just the generic reading that I do on the subject, the conferences I attend. I do a fair number of speaking engagements, not as much these days as I used to do, but I still do a fair number of them. Then I'm involved in one major project called Synergique, which is a collaboration between ourselves, University of Moncton, and Desire to Learn. I'm the research lead on that project. The project itself is to develop collaborative content authoring technologies in learning management systems. We have four areas of research that I manage. There's distributed digital rights management, automated metadata extraction, learning design accelerators, and workflow systems. And so a big part of what I do is trying to coordinate that kind of work.
Wow, it's hard to nail down exactly all the different things you do.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Then my big project is called Plurn. It's a personal learning environment project. Just got started up this year. And as the name suggests, it's to develop a personal learning environment system. I won't say application because it's not going to be a single application that comes out of this. It'll be a set of tools and processes. And so I'm managing all aspects of that project. And involved in that project is an online course, which we're hosting. I just did a session of that earlier today. As well, we've got project blog, we've got the website, the wiki, and then the actual application being developed, and there are different areas of that application. So we've got a team of researchers and programmers working on that. And
Well, let me stop you there for a second. Just for people who don't know, and this I had this down as one of the bullet points that I'd like to discuss with you. For the people who don't know, can you explain what a personal learning environment is?
Yeah, sure. But not quickly.
It's hard to nail down as well.
It is hard to nail down. Right now, most online learning takes place in what is called a learning management system. And if you've been involved in e-learning or online learning at all over the years, you've probably run across one of these things. Blackboard is a learning management system. Desire to Learn is a learning management system. The old WebCT is a learning management system. And the idea of these learning management systems is a student will log on to the system and then access course resources, such as readings and assignments, take part in course activities, such as discussions or exercises, and perhaps take tests and quizzes and have their grades uploaded and their gradebook and that available through the system. Now, that's all very nice, except it's all based around the system. It's all based around the institution, around the university. And when a person finishes their course and moves on, all of their learning, all of their materials and that vanish. They go away. They may stay inside the institutional system, but the student no longer has access to them. Also, you know, if you're in one learning management system from one institution, if you want to study at another institution, that's typically a completely different system with a separate logon, separate files, separate resources. So, you know, all the different parts of your learning, if you're learning from more than one place, which more and more people are these days, it's all separated. So the idea of a personal learning environment is to provide access to those services, educational content, educational services, discussions, forums, exercises, but to do it from a personal application rather than an institutional application. So the personal learning environment is something that you own as a learner, that you use, you configure in your own way, and then it will reach out and access resources from various places on the internet. And because it does this, we can take advantage not only of institutional learning management systems, but really any of the online services and resources that are out there. So we can take advantage of institutional databases, repositories of learning resources, social network services like Facebook or MySpace, conferencing facilities such as Illuminate or Centra or Adobe Connect, and anything else that you can think of that might be useful in support of your own learning. So the idea of a personal learning environment is it puts you in control of your own learning. It provides access to a wide range of learning resources and not just those available in your university, and it lets you take control of your own learning and manage your own learning your own way.
So as and I know that there are a number of different approaches to this, but do most of them actually download the content or download the resources to your personal client, or do they typically on the fly consume the resources from, you know, API interaction or web service type interaction when you're connected to the network?
Well, I mean, right now there aren't a whole lot of personal learning environments out there for most of them to do anything, right? So this is a very new category. There are no systems right now that people can use and say, oh yeah, this is my PLE. So really the only way to understand the question is, how do people use the web now, just generically? And it's interesting because I think most people accessed most content simply through their web browser, and they just access the copy of the content wherever it happens to be now, and they read it, and then they close their browser, and they don't typically download stuff to their own computer. Now, there are exceptions. Software is probably the biggest exception, where you might download something to install it, maybe an extension or a theme for your browser. Music podcasts. Files, podcasts, these are contents that would typically be downloaded and then played later. And the predominant reason for that is simply file size, right? It's easier to download your audio or your video at night when you're not using your computer and then listen to it from your computer the next day. It's just the bandwidth isn't there to allow for easy streaming. Particularly if you're on the road and you're making do with your 3G wireless telephone connection. Right. Who calls it wireless telephone? Nobody calls it wireless telephone. that was interesting. A lot of resources, and if you're at your desktop, most resources, you're just going to stream. I was sitting here listening to some music just before you called, and I didn't download it and then played it. I just streamed it off the player, because why would I download it and play it? I don't even know if I want to keep it. Right. Some people keep libraries. I have a little library of PDFs. It's not a big library, but I have it because I just like to have a little backup reading for the airplane, stuff like that.
I was just wondering, because we're looking at, you look at the different types of content that's out there, and you look at sort of the open education movement, and you look at some of the schools that have put up their courseware. A lot of it is, and I'm not sure that this, that's a sort of a different topic, but a lot of it is video of the classroom experience, or it is audio recordings. It is these larger files. And I know they're also, the PDFs, and they're the wiki pages potentially. But it seems like a lot of the content is a larger file format.
Well, so I was wondering. Yeah, that's true. But, I've got a library of all of my presentations on my website. And since 2004, I've been recording the audio. So I don't know, I got 110 or so audio recordings. And I've been recording video on some of them, a smaller number, because it's more of a pain to record video. And the way you access my presentation on my site is you go to the presentation page. There's the audio that you can either download, or it's not working right now, but I also had it in an Odeo player. It's odeo.com. They're down for retooling right now. I don't know if they'll ever come back, but they were pretty nice when they were there.
So that was where Twitter was spawned from, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was the same people, actually. And it's just Twitter was so popular and Odeo, wasn't. but I liked it. I was the only person in the world who liked it, which is interesting. My slides are there, and you can just click through them because they're embedded in the web page in SlideShare. Mm-hmm. The video, there's always, anytime I have video, there's a link to the video, but really they're going to watch the video through the embedded YouTube plugin or the embedded Ustream plugin. So almost nobody downloads the audio or the video of my presentation. These are big files too. This is an hour and a half presentation. These are big files, not little files. And what they'll do is they'll go to the web page and they'll stream them straight from the web page. And I would say that's how the majority of people view the content that I've created. And I would say that if the audio and video from classes were presented to students in this way, this is probably how they would view them.
Is live streaming. Live streaming, not live, but streaming.
But streaming, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I think you're right. It's just, you know, I vacillate between feeling that people prefer the model of the podcast where, you know, say iTunes is on, I'm subscribed to the podcast, a new episode arrives and it just loads silently in the background. And whenever I sync my iPod or sync my phone, it's just there.
Yeah.
You know, and I think some people like that format, and I know that connectivity is becoming more ubiquitous, but it's still pretty sketchy when you're talking about big files and mobile streaming.
Well, yeah, it's the mobile aspect of it, right? If we weren't mobile, then who would care, right? We could stream everything, but, you know, bandwidth on mobile phones just isn't there. And so you want to carry it around with you.
Yeah, and you know, with the iPad, I know you're a little bit down on the iPad, but with that form factor and whatever may come to be that form factor, if it does catch on, which I think it has a good chance of catching on, you know, that's another device on which I think this type of learning could be useful. This type of sort of time shifting of lectures or audio recordings or, you know, slideshows with audio.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the presentation pages I was just talking about, I also have links for people to download the audio and video themselves, because I know some people are going to want to do that. And, you know, I have my iPod, and I've got, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000, whatever number of songs on my iPod. And I don't stream my music. I listen to it off the iPod because it's a lot easier. I can select it. There's no latency, no lag. I can organize it however I want. I don't need to worry about, you know, the rules regarding radio station broadcasts. You know, you can only broadcast 3 songs by the same artist, and you can't broadcast, you know, stuff like that.
Right. All the Pandora little issues.
Yeah. So it gives me control over my own music, which I really like and I really want, and I would not give up. Mm-hmm. So really, I mean, the answer to the question is there's always going to be a mix, right?
Right.
And so we want to be able to support that mix. So some people will stream, some people will download, some people like me and like you, I'm sure, will do both. And, you know, you want to just be able to support whatever works best under the circumstances.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, that brings up the topic of what courseware will be. I just had a discussion. I'm not sure if you know Lance Dublin, but we had a discussion recently about courseware and the name course and courseware the term, and he hates it.
I'll bet you, yeah.
But what is it going to be in the future? We have a backlash against Flash at the moment, which I think is well deserved, but there isn't an authoring tool to let you do what you can do in Flash in HTML5 yet. And HTML5 and Canvas and the ability to have vector animated artwork isn't across all the browsers. I don't think IE is going to have it until IE9. Maybe they have an IE8, but I don't think they have full support yet. So, you know, Flash to me seems like it'll be dying out as the format for most courseware. I have a feeling that video is going to take over a lot of that. And maybe not video in the way that currently is being recorded and disseminated over the web from MIT and the other institutions that are doing that. But rather, have you looked at the Khan Academy?
Who?
Sal Khan at the Khan Academy.
Yeah, I have. That's the set of, like, I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of these video lectures on different topics, kind of in the sciences, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think he's up to 1,000.
I didn't count them.
I did a podcast with him a couple months ago. And I really, you know, being in this industry and exposed to so much, and I feel like a broken record because I talk about this pretty frequently, but the way that he approaches this really excited me, because he's, first of all, the production quality of it, He's not worried about making it a Hollywood production.
Right. Me neither.
You know, he's more worried about the effectiveness of it. Sure. And that's why he's been able to put out so much of it. Mm-hmm. But he captures these, screen capture, and he's drawing on the screen,
mm-hmm.
And he's talking while he's drawing. And a lot of it's math and science, but he's moving into history at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that made a lot of sense. And I think a lot more people are going to try to convey subjects that way. I'm not sure. Do you have a feel for that? Do you have any feel for where courseware or courses or whatever you want to call it, knowledge units, are going mm-hmm. in the future?
Well, I like knowledge units. I think clearly you're right in the sense that this is an approach people are going to take. I mean, you know, this whole idea of screencasting, using things like Camtasia, using simple video recording. I mean, we've reached the age now where anybody can record a video and can convert it to any video format. That's why YouTube exists, because we have this capacity now. So, there will be, is being now created a large library of these learning resources, some good, some bad, some indifferent. But by and large, they're pretty good. I mean, I learned about Stirling engines by browsing through YouTube. I had never heard of them before. And now I know why they call it internal combustion instead of just combustion. And Stirling engines are external combustion. I'm sort of sitting there, wow, well, that makes so much sense. And it just, anyhow. So I had this fascinating sort of jaunt through a whole pile of YouTube videos that were very amateurly produced. Some guy out there with his solar heater and his Stirling engine and his power generator. Just amazing. And I learned a lot.
It taught you something.
It taught me something. But that said, there's two things that I think mitigate that or mitigate against that a little bit. And the first of these things is the video format itself. And the video format is linear, which means that it consumes time, which means that if you have a very specific need for a piece of information, video isn't a good way of presenting it or finding it, because video is not really random access. And even if it were, to actually receive the information, you have to kind of sit and wait for it. That's my big problem with the Khan Academy, right? There's this beautiful, huge library. It would take a lifetime to watch all those videos. I can actually acquire the same content more quickly and more efficiently using different technologies, and especially for me anyways, print-based technologies and image-based technologies, because I read much faster than people speak. Much faster.
That's a great way to look at it. And that's sort of, that's a what I would want to ask you. I mean, you have Wikipedia out there, which is an amazing resource, I believe. And Sal uses Wikipedia a lot to do research for some of the subjects that he teaches. Some he already knew sometimes. But but I would say that his videos, which are only 10 minutes long, capture something and add value in a way that may be more time-consuming to try to attain on your own by digging through Wikipedia or digging through online resources.
Depends on your need, right? I can, because I'm pretty good at this stuff, I can find the information I need right away. Take my Stirling engines again. I watched a bunch of videos, but a lot of the content I accessed was also text-based content and image-based content. The theory behind them, that was presented to me in text. The actual seeing them work and how they're put together, that was presented in video. But understanding what the engines looked like, I wanted a schematic diagram for that. And that was a better way for me to access that information. All of that's very personal to me, right? And so the way I learn best about, in this case, Stirling engines, is this kind of combination of resources that's been put out there, and that will be particular to me. Somebody who maybe doesn't read as well or as fast, somebody who approaches, you know, who's more audio focused than video focused, they may find the videos a lot more useful. It might take them a little longer, but then again, they may get a deeper knowledge of the subject than I do. It may become more of a memory, more of an imprint for them than it would be for me. For me, being exposed is enough. And I, oh, yeah, okay, I kind of get it good enough. You know, I'm not out there trying to build one, so okay. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, well, it's going to be this combination.
Is that an argument against traditional classroom training?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, this is something I think people have been saying for a long time. A classroom is, you know, minimally one size fits 30, or, you know, in the university it's one size fits 200 or whatever, until you get to grad school, but then you're still, you know, one size fits 5. You know, I spent a lot of time in my education waiting for other people to be educated while I kind of twiddled my thumbs, or, well, my notebooks are filled with drawings of cities and urban planning in the margins, because that's what I did while I was waiting for stuff
sink in with your fellow students.
Yeah, you know, go through the example the 45th time. I exaggerate, obviously. And I will, just to be fair, admit that I took up a great deal of class time, not so much from lack of understanding, but rather from lack of belief. You know, and so I would raise various objections, considerations, counter-arguments, observations, all of that. Well,
especially in philosophy.
Especially in philosophy, yeah. So, yeah, people in my classes got as much of me as they did the teacher, and they didn't always appreciate that. Now, there's a second aspect, too. I mentioned there were two aspects, or two mitigating factors. The second factor is videos are non-social. They're non-interactive. Video conferencing is interactive, and I think recordings of video conferences will be a very interesting thing that we don't have a whole lot of so far, although, you know, as recording capacities of things like Skype come into the fore, we'll see more of it. I've seen a few of them. But even generally, you know, learning is very seldom a solitary activity. That does not mean you cannot learn on your own. You can, obviously. I learned about Stirling engines all by my lonesome, and it didn't matter who produced the material or who was out there, who was talking about it. But by and large, when people are learning things, especially if it's a fairly wide domain and if it's fairly in-depth knowledge, they will want to learn with, you know, a group of people, a community of people. That doesn't mean they all march through the stuff lockstep, but it does mean that they share some sort of affinity. You know, one experience that I'm having right now is I'm subscribed to a feed from a website called the Orwell Prize. And what they've been doing now, we're into almost the third year of this, is replaying George Orwell's diaries from, we're up to 1940 now. We started sometime in 1938, and we've gone through a lot of reports on farms and farming implements and the infamous egg counts, and the price of eggs as it's gone up and down, and his trip to Morocco. But now we're into the 1940s, and the war has just started, and we're getting some really interesting stuff. There's a group of us, I have no idea how large this group is, that have been following this thing for the last 2 years. So it's just a fascinating insight into his character. I'll never read an Orwell book the same again, ever. And, you know, we're going through this, and each diary entry is a blog post, and then after each blog post, you see all the comments back and forth between the bunch of us as we comment on all the different things that have been happening, add resources, add links, provide background information, and the rest. And this kind of community involvement in learning a subject, even something as intangible as you know, George Orwell's diaries, I think is really valuable and isn't present in simple video presentations. That doesn't mean you can't do it, but you know, there's sort of, it's harder.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah, I actually had not heard of that. That's extremely interesting. I haven't heard of anything really like that either. I'm sure it has gone on, but it's a great concept. So you're just, they're going through, what is it, weekly or
daily? Every day.
Daily.
Every day he writes something, we read what he wrote for that day. And it's like day by day. So like today's June 4th, and June 4th, 2010, in his diary, it's June 4th, 1940. So exactly 60 years ago to the day. And, you know, it is really interesting seeing it from that perspective. And it's not,
well, that's putting a time element to something that really doesn't necessarily need one, and it sounds like putting the time element to it makes it more beneficial or more engaging in some way.
More beneficial, more engaging. It also makes it easier. It doesn't occupy a lot of my time to follow this, right? Mm-hmm. Cumulatively, it's probably taken hours and hours and hours. But, you know, in any given day, it's just a few minutes. I'll read the thing. I'll reflect on it. I might write up a little comment or read the other people's comments. Not very long. It's a lot of fun. But, you know, over time, I'm getting this rare, in-depth insight into George Orwell.
Hmm. Yeah, that's incredibly interesting. Well, that's a different type of learning than just your typical, say, flash presentation or video presentation or just a Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
At some point, and maybe there'll be many different delivery methods. Well, of course, there'll be many different delivery methods that we could choose on the internet. But I feel like what we're trying to recreate, in many cases, is that we each have an individual tutor who knows everything. And when I try to envision what the future may be, and obviously this is so far away, it's almost absurd to even talk about, but is artificial intelligence that could interact with you and actually teach you, learn your, understand your learning style, adapt the way you learn, present you the information in the best format for you, using different methods for different subjects, and take you, you know, from point A of not knowing something to point B, the most efficient route that it can, having understood you. And I know some people are working on different aspects of that, mm-hmm. but in reality, in science fiction, it would be something that you just speak to, or it would be natural. It would be a natural interaction. We wouldn't be as worried about the interface or the piece of software. It would be much more like talking to a human and interacting with a true human teacher, I would take.
Yeah, that's going to be tricky. I mean, there will be many aspects of what you describe that will be possible in the shorter term. I think that we're not that far away from a fairly intelligent selection and presentation of resources that adapt to your interest and your learning style. We're already seeing a lot of applications begin rudimentary presentations of that. We have Genius in iTunes, which selects songs and tries to sell you other songs, as one example of that.
Amazon's algorithms.
YouTube is recommending videos based on what I've previously read or watched. TiVo is well known for that. These are all pretty primitive, you know, like with YouTube. I just started watching YouTube in Opera yesterday just because I wanted a different experience. And so there's YouTube adapting to me, you know, all over again, because it doesn't know that I'm the same person in Opera as I am in Firefox. So there you go. That's kind of an interesting thing right there. So, and I'm sort of afraid, you know, there's one of these, it's not a frog in a blender, but it's one of these stupid little videos. I don't want to hit it because I don't want YouTube to start recommending me all of these, you know, human stunt videos. When I go to YouTube, generally I'm looking for music videos because that's kind of what I like at YouTube. I really like the music videos. And, you know, maybe some academic and presentation videos, and definitely not, Fred falls off a roof. It's generally not what I'm looking for, not what I want recommended. But the thing is, if I view one, for the rest of my life, YouTube will think that that's what I like.
So it doesn't weight it?
It doesn't really weight it. No. So
that seems silly. Seems like a silly oversight that could be easily corrected.
Well, you'd think, right? But, it's...
Maybe it works against you in the sense that there's so much more of that type of content. So if you hit that sort of honey hole of a video like that, it just there's so much other content like that that it's the easiest thing to recommend.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a factor. Yeah, no doubt about it. So, but I mean, all that's to say, you know, this stuff is just in its infancy. But this is coming like gangbusters. So, our applications will get smarter and smarter. I was in a meeting this morning where people saying, you know, oh, if only I had this kind of, analyzer, plain text, understander, you know, so I don't have to codify everything. And I'm sort of saying, well, those already exist. They're all over the place, and they really are. National Research Council, about 10 years ago, came out with a product called Copernic, which is an automatic summarizer of written text. And there are algorithms, and I know of a bunch of algorithms now that will take this text, will analyze this text, will give you a nice summary, will give you a bunch of keywords, will classify it, sort it, slice it, and dice it. It will do all that for you. But what's missing is the infrastructure in which something like that is going to operate. And you know, we have an infrastructure right now where... it can't tell that I'm the same person when I use a different browser. That's not smart. And that's why you get things like that.
Has anyone ever discussed, I meant to look this up, but it seems to me the simple solution for that would be that you would sign into your browser, and there would be, your browser would know who you were and would negotiate your identity with sites. Yeah.
You know, and I actually invented something that does that. It's called... MIDM. It was a bit of a hack, but what it did is it allowed you to enter your identifying URL, and it actually put it in the browser type header, so that when you use a browser and you access a website, your browser sends the website some information about itself. I'm Firefox, I'm version 6.0, I have this, and this plugin. I support HTML such and such, my native language is such and such, my IP is such and such. You know what I mean? All of these are in the header of a request for a web page. So I stuck this URL into the header. I had a way of inserting it into the header of this request. So... basically, I signed into my browser, and then on the website, there's a way you get this information from the header. It's a URL. You check the URL so that you know that I am, in fact, who I say I am, and not just somebody who says I am who I say I am. So you go back and forth, and there are some well-known processes of authenticating that sort of information. It never took off, because 6 days later... a guy called David Ricordon came out with something called OpenID.
I'm a big fan of OpenID.
And OpenID, you have to, it's the same concept, with the URL, except it's not in the browser header. You have to type it into a form yourself.
It doesn't make any sense. I think Mozilla is working on something that's going to be embedded into Firefox, but who knows if that'll take off, and the Firefox seems to be slowly dying. Hopefully not. Hopefully they'll have a resurgence.
The Firefox is sort of funny, isn't it? I think they're sort of stuck around 30-40%, and now with Chrome coming on, and Opera's always kind of been there, Safari, which never worked for anything, now is the only browser, it seems, that Apple supports. I mean, the browser market is sort of suddenly heated up again, so I think that's really interesting. But they're talking about having some sort of identification system in the next version of Firefox. Will this work? Who knows? And also, Firefox has Weave, which is a synchronization system. Opera has Opera Unite, which turns your desktop into a web server, so you can serve your own identity that way. There are different approaches to this, but there's no single approach. And almost, it seems, no desire for a single approach. All of these organizations and companies still want to own the entire marketplace. I think they should have just adopted MightyMe.
been done with it.
It was such a simple solution. Right? Put the URL in the browser header, you're done.
It makes total sense. It should be managed inside of the browser. You should sign into your browser.
Yeah, and that's what you did. You just sign into the browser, and the scripts were simple. The risk of intercepting or man-in-the-middle attacks was minimal. It was actually more secure than the logon, user ID and password that we use now. Because you were always with MightyMe, just like OpenID, you're redirected back to your own personal site, and whether it's your site. You can tell whether it's your site, and there are lots of ways to secure your site, to give you codes that only you will recognize, so that people can't fake your site. So it would have worked, and I'm kind of disappointed that they didn't go in that direction. But now we have these branded single sign-on. So sign on with Facebook Connect, right? Sign on with your Google account. Sign on with your Yahoo account. They're all trying to corner this market on single sign-on, and it's so annoying.
It's unbelievably annoying, and I hope they wake up and they put it in the browser. And at least they do seem to. I will say that this for these standards that seem to be popping up every other year. OAuth 2 actually makes sense, whereas OAuth 1 was just sort of a mess. And OpenID, I thought, was always just, I didn't think that was that great of an idea, the way that it was implemented in the first place. But now that they're sort of converging on OAuth 2.
Exactly, yeah. OpenID plus OAuth is. Yeah. I mean, that's an improvement. And then if they put the thing in the browser.
Exactly. That's the last remaining step.
I just do that. I would have done that first, but
it should be. So I don't know. I look at the current state of what courseware is like and courses and how we interact with information. And as I said, I've try to project out and say, okay, in a perfect world, you'd have artificial intelligence that could lead you through it and present it to you in the best format that was right for you for the particular subject matter and your level of expertise. And as you said, we can get very far where we are today along that path.
Oh, yeah.
But there doesn't, hopefully we will start doing that. It seems like there's been so much talk about it for so long, and the implementations of anything that is along that route are usually not very good. And you look at something like SCORM and the whole thought process behind SCORM and simple sequencing and the idea of being able to take these small units, p piece them together, take your individual SCOs, these little units of knowledge, and piece them together into a SCORM course, and then be able to reuse them as well, so that you could take little individual blocks of content and, depending on what you need to know, on the fly, have them piece themselves right. together. I mean, it's a great idea, but it was just a terrible mess.
Yeah.
You know, having had to implement that before, it's just awful. And I don't know, is there anything, are you seeing anything new coming out? I haven't really been paying attention to SCORM. I've been blocking it out. I mean, they're trying to reapproach SCORM. Have you heard anything along those lines that may help us get sort of partially to the perfect scenario?
Let me think here first. Because, you know, there's a bunch of stuff. There's a bit of a resurgence in some of this stuff that's been happening out there. IMS has come back with a couple of things that are interesting, which aren't really SCORM, but may actually help leverage SCORM-like stuff. One of them is the Common Cartridge format, and this is Learning Objects Lite. One of the big problems with Learning Objects was they standardized the metadata, but they never standardized the object. So who cares if you could find it? It would never play. And even SCORM was, you know, was not consistently implemented across platforms. So it was always intended, you know, you have one SCO here, one SCO there, it would play anywhere. But in fact, you know, they didn't play anywhere. So IMS came out with Common Cartridge. And Common Cartridge, as the name suggests, implies a type of content that's supposed to actually just plug in and play anywhere. And along with Common Cartridge, they came out with sample code and implementation so that people could actually see, here's how it works. Here's how it's implemented. And there's, I think there's also, as I recall, a certification aspect for it too. The content is certified, Common Cartridge compliant, and there are certain minimum requirements that you have to support in order to be Common Cartridge compliant. And then on top of that, the other thing that was a big problem with SCORM is the content was, you know, the package was completely self-contained. And that meant, you know, and that was fine for the military's purposes because the military was operating on the model of training manuals, right? So we get these training manuals in digital format. Those will plug in. And basically, they're page turners. But, you know, for the kind of learning where you want something that's a bit more interactive, something that will, you know, engage in some elements of the LMS, some of the testing capacities, some of the conferencing tools, etc., you need your learning resource to be able to plug into these things. But of course, every system has its own suite of tools. So IMS came out with LTI, Learning Tools Interoperability. And what that is a mechanism that allows a content object, such as a Common Cartridge object, to call and instantiate an instance of a tool inside a learning management system where the actual instance of that tool is defined by the learning management system rather than the Common Cartridge. So basically what that means is your learning resource can call tools in your environment that are native to your own environment using this standard process. So these have potential to be the sort of thing that is, you know, a lot more useful, certainly in, well, I don't want to say industrial, but I'll say it, certainly in an industrial learning environment where you need to, like, fire a lot of content around in a hurry. You know, Common Cartridge plus LTI offers you a lot of flexibility and portability. Still doesn't solve all of the problems. It really doesn't solve, you know, the whole learning community side of things, but it does produce this set of resources. But, you know, from where I sit, it's still overkill.
That's the thing, is all of these seem to push or complicate creating these units of knowledge.
Yeah.
And what we should be doing is getting out of the way of people creating this and make it as easy as possible to utilize. And the best model is just the open web, right?
HTML5. Of course, HTML5 is kind of complicated.
So, but you know, you want to make it so that people can just create their content as easily as possible, put it out there, and that it can be consumed. And it doesn't seem like it should be as hard as they're making it. I feel like a lot of times they're padding the or making these things more difficult to in order to charge consulting fees to teach people about it.
Well, they're all playing the same game, and the game is portability plus client lock-in.
Right.
So, you know, this is the same thing with these identity standards, right? Google and Facebook and Yahoo, they'll play with OpenID, but then they'll roll out their own branded, locked-in versions of it. You know, and then look at the mess that is video formats. It's the same sort of thing, right? They all agree we should have, you know, common video formats, and they agree that the common video format we should have is theirs. And of course, that means we have, I don't know, five, six, whatever major candidates for these common video formats. And then, as usual, Macintosh, Apple will play it their own way, no matter what everyone else does. So,
Well, they have Microsoft on board now for the H.264 MPEG-4 format.
Yeah. So,
It's tough. And I'm not sure, you know, in that regard, because we have a software as a service learning management system,
right?
And you know, there doesn't seem like an easy decentralized way to create something like that. And you still have to have at least a centralized record keeping because of just the function of a corporate learning management system or an organizational learning management system. I try to think as much as I can about what would the perfect scenario be where you could open this up and allow people to create content more easily. You can obviously create authoring tools like YouTube. You know, you record the video on YouTube. YouTube doesn't really care what format it is. You just upload it to it. It takes care of all the work for you and then spits it out in a way that people can easily consume it. So that methodology, I think, works. People don't even have to think about it. But then you get into the authoring tool, and as you say, like the vendor lock-in with the authoring tool, it's a hard nut to crack to figure out how to give people the freedom to basically get out of their way.
Yeah.
But still make it extremely easy for them.
Yeah, there's almost no corporate model that includes the phrase "get out of their way." That's the problem.
I would like to get out of people's way.
it's like I remember when I lived in Edmonton, I had to drive up north. I used to drive up to northern Alberta and teach in First Nations reserves, and on the highway just north of Edmonton is the city of St. Albert, and the city of St. Albert has I think it's 8 stoplights on St. Albert Trail, which is the highway that runs through St. Albert. Now, I drove this road a lot and came to the conclusion that it was not possible to drive through St. Albert without stopping, and generally without stopping 3 or 4 times. And the reason, of course, is they want you to stop at their businesses, and the best way to do that is to get you to stop at a stoplight. Otherwise, you'll just drive through. So the interests of St. Albert were at odds with the interests of me. I want to get to my destination, but St. Albert, in order to thrive as a business community, needs to stop me, interrupt me, and actually pull me off the road. And that's the same sort of conflict we have on the web.
Yeah, I mean it's a sort of universal conflict, right? I mean, if you apply that to sort of the open education movement and what's going on in learning software, you know, it's sort of a balance. I do believe that the competition and the marketplace and the desire to make money does help fuel innovation. I do think that occurs, but at the same time, you get the opposite effect where you have something like Microsoft. doing this or doing that in an anti-competitive way and setting us back probably a decade on the web because of their stranglehold on the browser.
Yeah.
It works both ways, and it's hard. I think it's hard sometimes to know where to, where to regulate or where to put your own time. You know, you look at Google.
Yeah.
Google forever for me has been a company that I've really admired, and recently they've gotten to the point where they're big enough and they have enough of people's information, and Apple as well, where you start to feel differently about them.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you know, you wonder, okay, are they big enough now? Is their stock price to a point now where they are going to have to do whatever it takes to continue to bring in those levels of revenue, and the consumer is going to suffer? And I don't know, it's a difficult thing to understand, but to apply that back to education, and Sal's a great example. You know, Sal currently is looking for a sponsor, and I'm not sure if he's found one yet. It's been a while since we had our conversation, but you know, he's relying on somebody, an outside entity, to essentially fund him.
Yeah.
And he has no way of, he does have a way to make money from the advertising to sustain himself from the advertising through the YouTube videos.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really not enough right now for him to break even with his sort of monthly expenses.
Right.
And not only that, one guy shouldn't be doing this. It should be a model that can be reproduced by other people. And there don't seem to be that many other people trying to do it in the same way. Maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a bad thing. But
well, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of work. It takes dedication. And
yeah.
You want people to be financially rewarded for that dedication. But that seems to be at odds with the whole open education movement and the whole idea of making these things open and free, which I also totally believe in.
Yeah, and you know, I think part of it is the model where we expect these things to be commercially successful, which means that they have to have their own independent revenue stream. You know, I think that there is an alternative way of looking at this, and it has been touted to some degree and denounced to some degree. You know, we currently spend X number of dollars on our educational system, and I think the provision of resources like this actually reduces the cost of the educational system, or more accurately, will in the future have the potential to reduce the cost of the educational system. So I can see an argument for a level of social support for these sorts of endeavors. But part of the problem is, once you get into social support for endeavors, that often turns into governance models and structure and, various other...
And politics seeps into it.
Yeah. So, you know, the commercial model works against the public interest because it increases the cost of things that really ought to be relatively inexpensive. The public model works against it just because of these other factors. But I do think there is that midway point. My work, for example, is publicly funded, and everything is fine until they say that my software has to make money. The minute you say that, it's sort of, well, now I'm in a contradiction between writing software that will serve the education community the best possible way versus serving some set of investors the best possible way. And that's the contradiction that we're facing right now. And it's not an easy contradiction to find ourselves a way out of, because there's no easy answer to this.
Well, yeah, I agree. When I look at it, because I have to look at it that way.
Yeah.
I try to think of it in terms of if you make the best product for the person that is using it, if you can make the best product for them that makes their lives the easiest,
yeah,
then you will be profitable.
Yeah.
And instead of worrying about, you know, trying to trick people into locking them in, and I think a lot of, I think that, you know, people like Facebook and a lot of the stuff that they're doing with privacy, I think people are jumping the gun on that. I think they're thinking that they're out for money in the way that they're changing their privacy policies. I think they just messed up. I really don't think that it was like a planned way to make more money. But I think a lot more people look at it that way. You make the best product you can, and then for people to give them what they want.
Yeah.
And you try your best to avoid any of the trappings of trying to create vendor lock-in or anti-competitive work. And then I think it makes it easier to find that balance.
Well, obviously, yeah. I mean, the big trick for a lot of people, I think, is that period of time between now and when you have that best possible product. And
yeah.
A lot of people, yeah. And the same in academic circles, right? So, you know, it's the same sort of thing. You know, you come up with the best ideas and the best writing that you can, and the means of support will be there. True. I think that is true. I'm a lot less worried about unemployment now than I would have been a while ago. But, you know, a lot of academics aren't there yet. They haven't produced that best possible work, and it's going to take them a certain amount of time and effort to get there, just as it takes, you know, software programmers a certain amount of time and effort to get their product to where they want it to be. And so the big question is, how do we bridge that? How do we get people from where they are to the position where they're able to offer these, you know, best of class kind of offerings?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, most of it is a typical method for a software realm is to go the VC route, and then that's going to, you know, obviously pressure you to find an exit event within 5 years.
Yeah.
And that exit event is going to be, predicated on being as profitable as possible, which may be contrary to your, what your consumers, would rather you do. It's hard to say. I don't know. it's easy for us because we don't have that pressure on us. We started, you know, a decade ago, and we're, you know, sort of bootstrapped, had some angel investors, and then just have been able to grow organically over the last decade. But I can see for younger people trying to start out, but it's so easy to start software companies now.
But it's not so easy to sustain them. I mean, you know, even back, you know, in the mid to late 1990s, I built a learning management system, just like Murray Goldberg's, except in certain ways, mine was better. It was certainly stable. It had a lot of features, and it had, modules and reusable learning resources, a little notebook, discussion area, chat room. But what it didn't have was angel funding. So I could build it, but I couldn't sustain it. And eventually.
But now, think about it now. Now with Amazon Web Services, it's so inexpensive for someone just getting started up. I mean, once you get off the ground and you have usage, and it starts getting expensive. But, you know, the assumption is that when you get to that point, you have revenue to be able to afford to pay for that.
Well, yeah, but now if you're doing that, you're doing the same thing 80,000 other people are doing because it's so easy.
I guess. I still feel like that so few people concentrate on quality, that so few people are really going over it and trying to refine it and then doing it again and, you know, self-editing and just trying to make it perfect. That so few people take the time and have the discipline to do that there is still tremendous opportunity. Most people, 99% of people, are trying to get there as quickly as possible, with as little effort as possible.
Yeah, the thing is, when you're building an economy, you have to build it for 99% of people.
Oh, yeah, you know, I'm saying most developers seem to be trying to get to the point, the shortest, you know.
I hear you.
But Well, Stephen, thank you so much. This has been. Is there anything else, you know, coming down the pike, I guess, that you'd like to talk about that you've seen that you find interesting?
No, I think the personal learning environment right now is the big thing for me, and you know, this is the sort of thing we've been talking about actually, and you know, for me, it's a question of getting that concept implemented in such a way that it serves the interests of the learners as much as possible, you know, and maybe that's the Canadian way, right? So, you know, as much as possible under the circumstances. But that's certainly what my objective is.
Well, I'm excited to keep following it and see where it's going. And I really enjoy reading your blog. So thank you for all the work that you've put into that. And for anyone that doesn't know, you can find Stephen at www.downes.ca, and that's D-O-W-N-E-S. But Stephen, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed it.
Oh, you're very welcome, Chip, and we'll have to do this again sometime.
Absolutely.
Thank All right, you. Then.
Okay, so I've stopped it. All right, great. That was excellent.